Blog Talk Radio.
Effects, a chance to put our heads together, to have that conversation that tends in a way to answer questions about whether Masons where you are have similarities to Masons where I am or over there. It's a community, but in a way, in metaphor, if you don't mind, is that we are in this together. And I don't say that glibly, because it's more than a thought, more than this fragment, this conceptual fragment. It's a truth. And it seems that it's giving us some unbearable questions. You think that the role, the function, the of Freemasonry may be to influence what's going on around. When you're thinking about it, we're not out to conquer the world or anything so vast, but we're wondering about the possibilities of influencing the person next to us and they influencing us. On a larger scale and spread very thinly throughout the world, I guess we could be challenged by somebody directing a finger at us, suggesting we are an ideology. But if this is an ideology, it's a pretty fragmented piece of work. I don't see any manifesto, and I think with the way we're encouraged to develop our own sense of merit, that's highly unlikely that we're going to see a threat to anybody or any big body of work that has, but we are a threat in terms of asking the question. You know, those types of situations, whether they're government or religious bodies or military, where the questions are disruptive. You know that, and there are times when it's best to hold your question because the work that's needed has an immediacy and an importance. But other than that, to generate commitment to sustain our growth and development and our ideas and ourselves, the questions are very, very important. So today, I'm looking at examining this matter of merit and the contradictions that can come out of that whole process. Let me put it that way. Part of my dilemma is that I don't know necessarily know your motivation. My determination of merit of you and your work needs to be looking at your frame of reference. I don't know if you and I share the same priorities, for example. Perhaps you're invested in, within the reasonable boundaries of Freemasonry, in spirituality, perhaps the growth of an extension of a philosophical understanding of, perhaps it's the communication, the way we bring all of the parts together. We call that politics. Or maybe it is, this awareness of, it's an awareness that is your sense of merit, that synergy of that all these parts, in, as I say repeatedly, need to be balanced in order for the harmony to occur. And I don't say balance as if I'm talking about entropy, where every note is the same tone and the every color is the same expression. I like the distinctions because it helps me define shape and form. You think of all of the different tones that come together in the mind when you close your eyes sitting in front of a symphony. There is that sense of the space between the notes. And once we all understand it and we wait for, we are not playing the symphony instrument. We are a component. We have a very important part. Now, any one part can distract from the mood that the composer was going for. You know what I mean. Any one part, a tone, a miss, we need to, when we make mistakes, it has to be imperceptible. Because we don't want the audience turning and saying, oh my goodness, no, it was so beautiful. We don't need the music stand falling over in the middle of the arpeggio. We don't. Recognizing that means that we can participate in that group. I don't think very many of us are ever given that opportunity to addressed in that way, to be appreciated for the uniqueness. Now, everybody in your orchestra might like to beat a drum, but if the work that you're developing requires a horn section, strings, and along with percussion, maybe it's a concerto and you're looking at the support of piano, a solo passage, work by Paganini, or the human voice. We need to know literally, no pun intended, we need to know the score. we need to see the transcript so that we know what the conductor is looking at and that we can read along. And when it comes to that time and moment when I have to perform my part and then communicate, have that overlapping communication so you know and pick up your part, it's not about me, it's about the audience, what we're giving to the audience. We're able to create. In my own awkward way, that's what I'm getting at when I talk about synergy. Yeah. And how can we do that? And how can I judge when it just sounds so many times like a just noise? Instruments untuned, people not knowing the overall piece that they're playing. So everybody coming to the stage playing the instrument that they want, not what the orchestra needs, playing according to the playing what they style of music that they like in their own timing, in their own volume. And what do you end up with? Confusion and noise and empty theater. A rejection of the chaos. Intellectually, it's important. Because when you've heard the beauty of, let's say you've listened to Bach, and you can actually compare that kind of transcendency with Haydn's work or Brahms or Chopin, we begin to expect. Freemasons are way down that road with expectations. The reputation is marvelous. Oh, I know people will kick up a fuss. We've had our embarrassments. You know, the anti-Masonic movement. Look in the Masonic dictionary under hubris and you'll see anti-Masonic. The points and counterpoints. Don't take our lesson. Don't take it for granted. But it builds up a sense of expectation internally and externally. Are we tribal? Well, yeah, 7.8 billion of us in this tribe. Are we dominant? It's an interesting question. Perhaps if knowledge, if fact, if reason is dominant, then yes, we seem to be. Are we good at it? Well, collectively, yeah. Individually, we seem too often to have walked into a lodge with our fist tightly gripping the sheets that we want to perform because we have an expectation of what beauty is. And yet when we are introduced, it's come, though, unfortunately, where I am, these really decent people haven't been given a fair explanation of what it is that we do. I guess in truth, what we factually do is live in confusion, listening to this noise ourselves and pointing fingers. I know what I'm playing and I know my piece and I'm ready for it. It's all the rest of you guys that are, I can't help it. You know, that everybody is in the horn section. I can't help that the music was written for violin. That's not me. The question is, are we at least musicians? Are we capable? know the work that it requires. And you and I know how cruelly we mocked those boys who practiced, that fell in love with the music. I don't mean the rockers that love the power of sound. No. I'm talking about people that had all those traits that were mocked and considered effeminate. Why would anybody spend a Saturday afternoon practicing at the piano? He must be a fool, or, oh my goodness, he must be gay. Remember? Anything but the truth, the merit, the recognition. Stupid little boys don't seem to have that unless they've had the advantage of a mentor that's pointed it out. That is able to connect. Do you ever think that you want to make a satisfying contribution to mankind without meeting the people that you're going to help? Well, you know, sometimes there are people that work in laboratories that do that. And in order to get there, because we don't have labs all over the place, we have to present our skills. And in order to do that, we progress through different tests or challenges. Not everybody does it. Maybe that's the roll of the dice. If you're a boy like me, who was taught from an early age that he's only fit to work in a factory, can you take books out of a library? And you know those voyages where you're visiting places and ideas, and then in your reading that nobody else around seems to care about or appreciate. Yeah, I'd like to wish that everybody had it. Enlightened upbringing, but you know better than that. Some had, we call it privilege, some had it, and still do. Good. To play beautiful music, we need to agree, not disagree. We need to agree that our performing our part is worth sitting back and absorbing this beautiful sound that we participate in producing. It's not, when you're on stage, do you ever get to be just on stage, or do you not hear it? You hear it. You hear it, and the reaction, the audience plays their part. Because they're expressing your thoughts. Look at all that hard work. I stand and I applaud you. Brava, brava. Because in your heart and mind, you're there too. And so I play my part. And this metaphor isn't lost in Masonic lodges. But it's, you see, we scratch our heads. Some of the ancient lodges found that. They found the score, the style. They could even change the style just to experiment. Maybe, we're contemporary orchestra. We want to look at something contemporary in our repertoire. And then others of us actually dare to question what different forms of art can do when they come together. If a symphony can perform harmony, what happens when we add that to theater and then to voice and produce? What do we have? The very first raves, the very first concerts were that. Did you did know that? big audiences. Performing our part. It makes it worthwhile if we think, I'm going to try and compete within myself to be a very good cellist, or to play the oboe, or the bassoon, or the piccolo, or the viola. And I'll do it and do it well, and then I'll present myself to see if I get that feedback from the conductor. Here, I'm not the conductor. I'm just playing an instrument, or I'm singing in the chorus. Sometimes I think I should I should dedicate myself to, like you think we should be dedicated to being the marquee, the voice, the Spaniard or the Italian that just brings tears to the eyes. Masonry is our opportunity. Discover this and then qualify, knowing that you have merit, and having you communicate that, well, it's not the bragging, here I'm the best with this. It's not that. The way that you communicate your talent is by grace. The lyric in your movement. What you do to defeat tension. How you talk about the music. You sit and do it as, like what we see with ritual, is it something to be endured and feared, like schoolboys trying to recite? Or do we embrace it and say full on, this helps define my connection with the world as a man, as a thinking, as a sensate, compassionate, empathic human being? Well, when you look at a painting, when you listen to a poem, when you see a play or hear a song, that's who you are, absorbing, enjoying, celebrating. You sit back today, fill your mug with whatever is fine in front of you, if it's that lovely cup of tea or the espresso, or a cappuccino here today, or if you're fortunate, a Merlot or a nice 20-year-old single malt. This might go with it. This is a performer that certainly gets into his work. Oh, Keith Jarrett. Thank you. We go through different configurations as we get older. I was reading a piece from Shakespeare about the seven stages of life, seven stages of man. And so that's why it makes me think that I believe I'm at the sixth stage. And yet, it starts, and you'll be familiar with this. This is from As You Like It. It starts with all the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant. You've heard that. It's worth thinking through things. No need to convince anybody about what's interesting and fascinating. Masonry is unparalleled. You may not like the format. I appreciate that. It's not for everybody. But for those who enjoy this type of phenomena, it's amazing. Here, I'd like to contribute this piece and see what you think. And just to open the conversation with you. I begin with, I've entitled it Merit in Contradiction. And part of it picks up on what I was talking about a little earlier about not knowing your nature. And the only way that you can communicate that to me, you can tell or let me know that first. Am I open to that? So that I'm making my judgments based on your merit. Right from wrong, good from bad. Who makes the call? What influences bear on us? Understanding ethics could not start at an early enough age, though most children are born with an innate ability to empathize. I'm talking about children who have, after they've been socialized, you know, because you start off with ego, and then we have to add id and superego, that some will struggle with ethics as if it's a burden to be endured. You've seen them. Others are elevated to search out common agreement, avoiding the mistakes that come from rashness. That's like observation. And there are many who learn by mistakes as if awakening conscience. Ah, that hurt somebody. I won't do that again. Long ago, religious leaders were sure fear of eternal damnation was sufficient motivation to maintain order. Even justifying murder was insufficient. We never came out of the dark ages because there was never an entrance or exit. We kept righting wrongs. The Renaissance gave us justification to think, and did we think? Every day, life didn't improve in any perceptible way. Gradually, and having the advance of hindsight, thinkers were able to define motive and outcome, asserting a primacy that made us rethink our conventional and traditional ways. It didn't stop abuses of power or hubris, but it did contribute later to the explosions in libraries and laboratories during the early 17th and 18th century, as became known as the period of enlightenment. Those thinkers who positioned to organize Freemasonry were under no utopian illusions. Even to this day, we see chaos and order at work in our lodges. What then for the likes of men who in the sixth stage of life are contemplative? or as I like to say it, contemplative. Enjoy the challenge. It isn't fear that makes a man learn. It is natural curiosity, given freedom of expression. And what better citations to call us together than those that celebrate imagination? I mean the arts and sciences. Inspired, accidental, attention to detail. So we ponder dreams and reality, as we always have done, undefeated, undeterred by the mountains yet to climb. Little Michele Petrucciani with his friend, a conspirator in this, Stefan Grappelli. What do you think? Shall I order another round and we can sit and linger just a bit longer? Yeah. I think that would be reasonable. I'm going to be sharing with you a poem by a fellow that died very young. He's, I think, 26 when he passed away. And he was, if being born to simple means is significant to you, then this fellow was born the son of a livery man. And made it quite well for an all. This is a fellow born in October 31st, 1795 in London. And he died in 1821 in Rome. And he's known as a romantic lyric poet. Short-lived, but Endymion, the name of the poem we're going to do today. Why the poetry of the Romantics? It's like why the music, why jazz? I don't try to emphasize the individual in terms of arrogance or swag. I don't like that. I know it happens. I prefer the humility of, do you remember Pavarotti in front of the audience? Oh, just magnificent, but beautifully, seductively humble in front of his audiences. As the gentleman who sat next to me, the very first time I listened to opera, Carlo Bergonzi in concert, well after, you know, the singers do their tours, he said, oh, and I was applauding wildly at his first piece. He cautioned me, he said, no. Open your eyes a little bit. And tenors have egos, and they'll perform better for the audience if they know they have to work harder. And so you just politely applauded the first, and politely applauded, and at the end, sure enough, Bergonzi was magnificent. Lesson learned. The humility, though. The individual, when you're that good and you can be that confident that you can be humble. Now tell me, how do you compare that with somebody's ego coming in, declaring themselves? It's like, my goodness, that's fine, but not here, not here. Romanticism in English literature is that form. And it began, it's said to have begun in the 1790s. And we're fortunate. The first phase of the Romantic movement in Germany was marked, it had innovations in content and literary style. It's like the Rococo and the Baroque periods. You know, it's a way of thinking. It's like masonry. It's a way of thinking. And it affected, there's a preoccupation with this, with the mystical and the subconscious and the supernatural. But around the 1805 to 1830s, it became identified by a quickening of cultural nationalism and, you know, the events going on around and a new attention to national origins. That's the search for validation, the oldest there being authentic. So we'll recreate the history because nobody was there, so we'll make up our own. And this is where we saw the appreciation of the work of Sir Walter Scott, often considered to have, did he invent the historical novel? Well, he certainly made it pronounced. And then this is where the works of John Keats and Lord Byron, the scandalous Freemason, scandalous, the Percy Shelley, imagine. But the work, the byproduct of the work of these guys was the emotion that they brought to their work. Remember, this period wasn't just about boys. Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, remember that? Busey Shelley's wife. And the Marquis de Sade, and E.T.A. Hoffman. There were different periods of it. The expression and the connection. And here, imagine having those thoughts and having no vehicle, means of expression or validation for them. Keep them to yourself. They're stoic. And we don't have those thoughts. Even today, I've heard men say that. Even today, men don't show emotion. My goodness. Somebody trapped in their own sensibility. Writing, he had, you know, if you concentrate, you imagine that all of a sudden the world around you is exciting and private. So it was a private. And you're able to make thought connections with things that you see, with images. And you're able to, and you have the vocabulary to connect with the themes that you've learned from classical literature. That's what we're hearing at Endymion and Meon by Keats. This is a play on Endymion. He was a handsome shepherd prince, and he fell in love with the moon goddess Selene. And when Zeus offered him his choice of destiny, he said, you know, as Zeus tended to do, Endymion chose immortality and youth in eternal slumber. He was laid out in a cave in Mount Latmus in Caria, where his lunar lover would visit him each night. Greek mythology. Huh? Here, let's see what Keats did with that. Title character searches for the source of the joy, and due to his discontentment, he faces different situations. And Endymion Keats takes in it, he embellishes the tolerably familiar story from the Greek mythology. He learned it in Chapman's Homer. I mean, a couple of years ago, we did a piece on visiting Chapman's Homer, one of the poems of Keats. But as each book is precedented by a traditional kind of introduction, like Milton uses in Paradise Lost, Keats generalized upon the experience before moving into his story. I won't read the whole thing, but how do I edit this for the time here? You've heard this from book one. A thing of beauty is a joy forever. Its loveliness increases. It will never pass into nothingness, but still will keep a bower quiet for us and a sleep full of sweet dreams and health and quiet breathing. Therefore, on every morrow are we wreathing a flowery band to bind us to the earth, spite of despondence of the inhuman dearth of noble natures and of the gloomy days of all the unhealthy and our darkened ways made for our searching. Yes, in spite of all, some shape of beauty moves away the pall from our dark spirits, such the sun, the moon, trees old and young sprouting a shady boon. For simple sheep and such are daffodils, with the green world they live in and clear rills that for themselves a cooling covert make against the hot season and mid-forest break, rich with a sprinkling of fair musk rose blooms. And such too is the grandeur of the dooms we have imagined for the mighty dead, all lovely tales that we have heard or read, and pointless endless fountain of immortal drink, pouring unto us from the heaven's brink. Nor do we merely feel these essences for one short hour. No, even as the trees that whisper round a temple become soon dear as the temple's self, so does the moon. The passion poesy, glory is infinite, haunt us till become a cheering light unto our souls and bound to us so fast that whether there is shine or gloom or overcast, they always must be with us or we die. O May, no wintry season bare and hoary, see it half finished. But let autumn, bold with universal tinge of sober gold, be all that me when I make an end. And now at once adventuresome I send my herald thought into a wilderness. There let its trumpet blow and quickly dress my uncertain path of green, that I may speed easily onward through flowers and weed.
Thank you.
James Carter, my goodness, what a talent. What I've been talking about is not suppressing your talent, but recognizing it. You don't get recognized in Masonic terms without the ability to understand that grace, that humility, that the greatest performers have exhibited. Here we're sliding into the backstory of Masonry, the history, and we're looking at a time and an opinion about developments that occurred. Like any organization, not static about Masonry. It evolves and adapts, or it dissolves. So I like to think that the need is what we're looking at is a spirited sense of developing talent and having working with concepts where people know what's expected and how to go after it, because we can't just expect the hoi polloi to understand that this is a grand symphony and we each have a role to play. And when we say it like that, we need to really explain it. And the explanation and the metaphor makes it clearer, then use it. Don't do something so esoteric that nobody knows what the hell you're talking about. If you're going to do this and approach this by an entry in sacred geometry, then explain the connections. Explain the connections, your version of the connections. Not just your excitement with it, because it could be so esoteric. Who in the world knows what's motivated you? That's you. That's what sparks your interest. But here, Jacobs takes us into, I don't know if I would consider this a darkness, but an inevitability in her work. She's talking about here, the assessment of virtues and benefits from Masonic membership. I'm going to do a piece coming up about whether people are coming to Masonry because it's stylish or because of its intellectual orientation or there's an attitude. But here, she's talking about the picking up on the assessment of virtues and benefits in its promotion of true citizenship and benevolence and class harmony. My goodness, in one of arguably the most socially stratified cultures in the period of England, to talk about class harmony, it masked the dissension that had been developing by the 1740s within Masonic lodges over the issue of fraternal equality. Brothers have begun to criticize the social exclusivity of some lodges and to demand a more genuine egalitarianism. The resulting schism and the emergence of ancient, or as it is sometimes called, Scottish Freemasonry had little to do directly with Scotland. And it was new rather than old. Its appearance in mid-century signaled a split within the order that left traces on both sides of the channel. By the 1760s, most lodges in the American colonies belonged to the ancient version of Freemasonry. They were no longer officially tied to the Grand Lodge of London. These new lodges proclaimed a more egalitarian ambience. Their literature suggests that these democratic tendencies, at least in the English-speaking world, included a dedication to ideals like virtue and merit, coupled with attention to the evils of corruption. All were themes dear to the country perspective. On the continent, interestingly though, the first known lodge to admit men and women as equal members and officers met in The Hague in 1751, and its records make specific reference to Scottish Freemasonry. In one sense, this is not surprising because the issue that divided the ancients and the moderns, as they dubbed the Grand Lodge, was the egalitarian nature of true Masonry. Oh, I'm going to have to add to this. There is an element, a strong element of racism that was going on. The English and the Irish, the suppression, the pushback on the Irish. And it's a compelling argument that it gave rise to the progress of Irish Masonry into as an influence. You wouldn't charter Irish lodges, and it had to do with stigma. And then when the Irish went on chartering lodges, formed his own Grand Lodge, well, my goodness, let's play catch up. This is out of control because nobody's listening. But as she says, points out here, this notion of egalitarian, you can see what I'm saying here is this other research is pointing out that there was stratification. And it was racial, which makes sense when you think of the term. Excuse me, I need some. That's about as professional as I can get right now. We're going to plunge into the topic of the ancients. Long await. We're going to get into that the next time we sit together. And we'll explore this historian's version of those events. When we go about our business day by day, I don't know if anybody is expected to have all of these historic events constantly in mind, or as much as having the benefits, having the lessons taught by these things in mind, and applying them. In other words, so what? So what? There was a sense of concern about egalitarianism. So what? Well, the so what is, how does that apply to your, how do the events of that day apply to your thinking today? And remember, the qualifier here is that you're not the prima donna. You're not the solo performer. You could be, I don't know. But intellectually, if we progress according to merit, according to what form of merit? Is it declarative? You tell me that you have merit? Is it political suasion and opportunism? I don't know that. You may know that. What we tend to reach for is whether you're approachable and enough to understand the nature of man. Do we commune? Do we have things in common? Your performance could be quite esoteric. Do you brag about it? Is rank exercised as hubris? You're more important because of, I don't know that. I hear it, but I don't know that. I appreciate, like you do, the authenticity of a man who is convincing and believes in what he's saying. I'll leave it at that for this time. Thank you very much for indulging us and for your support. It means a lot. The preservation of our order is like preserving an idea. It's not going to be extinguished. The process is changing. And where I am, we're evolving and coming of age. And looking forward, we've had some growing pains. But we are coming of age. Right now we're, getting rid of some things that have become redundant. And it's creating opportunity for renewal, for continuation. I look forward to being with you next week, and I hope you'll be tuning in, committing acts of random Masonic kindness. Remember, go after the type that is tremendously satisfying when. And I don't want to beat this to death, but when you do commit an act of Masonic kindness anonymously, that's changes thinking. But what is remarkably, remarkably satisfying is when somebody discovers what you did. Not been there? You have a great experience to look forward to. Here, Chet Baker. Bye for now. Thank you.
Thank you.